From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take 2, May Martinez. Turns out the fire in Eagle Rock that shut down the Glendale Freeway was arson. A couple of men are in custody for setting fire to a homeless encampment. The people living in it were the targets. We'll hear about what can be done to stop attacks on the homeless. Plus, Scarlett Johansson says she believes Woody Allen. Find out why she might have felt okay about voicing an opinion that many people see as unpopular. It's ahead on Take 2. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, a much-debated bill that would limit vaccine exemptions is on its way to the governor's desk, but it's unclear whether he will sign it. We're going to check in on that midway through the show. Plus, we hear from author Walter Mosley on the elements of fiction.
Why do I love writing? That's a really difficult question.
First, though, we want to discuss what appears to be a rise in crimes against L.A.'s homeless. On August 25th, a brush fire erupted along the hillsides of Eagle Rock. About 300 firefighters converged on the scene to put it out. Today, the case against two suspects responsible will be presented to the L.A. County District Attorney. And according to the L.A. Fire Department, the blaze was part of an alleged attack to target homeless people living in an encampment. This type of case is not isolated. A report by the National Coalition for the Homeless says that these folks are more likely to be the victims of violent crimes. To talk about how we as a community in Southern California treat and care for the homeless, we have L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin. He represents parts of the West Side, including Venice. Councilman, welcome back to Take 2.
Thanks very much.
All right. Now, there aren't many statistics on the number of people targeted because they were homeless, but one survey of LAPD records showed that in 2019, there was a 22% increase in the number of homeless people who were victims of crimes compared to the year before, and that stat doesn't account for the motives behind a crime or even if it was between two homeless people. But what makes this population more vulnerable?
Well, I mean, let's just first state that, you know, the incident on the 25th and the rising trends of crimes against people who are homeless are horrifying and disgusting and appalling, and what the hell's the matter with people? People who are living on the streets right now are incredibly vulnerable to assaults, to rapes, to thefts, to being sucked into sex trafficking or drug trafficking. And this year alone, we've had 42 homicides among our homeless population in Los Angeles. When you're living outside and you do not have protection, you do not have shelter, that de facto makes you more vulnerable.
And a lot of times you don't have anyone to turn to for help.
And you don't have anyone to turn to help. And there's a growing climate of frustration in the city with encampments and with the slow pace in addressing homelessness, and it's really turning very ugly. I mean, if you look at social media in any of our council districts, there are all sorts of posts about use any means necessary to get rid of them, spray water on them, throw bleach-filled balloons at people, all this sort of dehumanizing rhetoric, and it's pretty frightening.
Yeah, almost like you're talking about like pests, right? Not even human beings.
It's a tried and true way of demonizing people. Is you talk about them as being subhuman, you talk about them as being dirty, and then you start making analogies to vermin. It's happened throughout history, and it's happening here. You know, there's a lot of your listeners who are probably appalled at the way Trump talks about immigrants. Take a couple Trump tweets. Substitute immigrant with homeless, and that sounds like a lot of what we're seeing out there right now.
We're talking to L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin. Now, there's been an effort, an unsuccessful one so far, to officially classify crimes against homeless people as hate crimes. Do you think that's necessary?
Yeah, I think it is necessary. I mean, you know, you have hate crimes legislation for populations that are particularly vulnerable, that are being attacked because of a trait that they cannot choose or change, and that describes the large majority of homeless people in Los Angeles.
What do you think about Angelino's attitudes toward the homeless? I mean, it's ramped up in the last few years. You even mentioned some of the things that are out there.
Well, you know, I understand that people are angry, and I understand that people are frustrated. How can you drive down the street and see encampments everywhere, or walk your kids to school past encampments and not be angry? That's natural. But that anger and that frustration has got to be channeled into solutions, into support for more homeless housing and support for more mental health programs, more drug rehabilitation services, more social services, and not into further victimizing people who are on the streets.
Now, today you announced that you'd like to form a new city commission composed of people who are or were homeless. Why? Why are you proposing this?
Well, you know, here in City Hall, for many issues, you know, there is a huge gap between our perception of the world and the reality out there on the streets. So it's very easy for us to say, you know, we're flooding the city with outreach workers and we're spending millions of dollars on these programs, have the sort of chest-thumping press conferences and feel good about what we're doing. But there's not sufficient appreciation of what's actually happening on the streets. And if you spend some time talking to people, you'll find that hundreds, thousands of people who are homeless have never met an outreach worker. Or when they get a phone number, they can't reach them because the voicemail is full or because the service agency closes it at 5 p.m. There's a huge gap between our understanding as privileged housed people who are not living that experience. And if we're going to be spending hundreds of millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money to try to solve this problem, we got to get it right. And we're not going to get it right unless we're talking to the people that we are supposed to be helping.
Now, you mentioned, though, Councilman, how powerless these folks can feel most of the time, and pretty much all the time. But what are the difficulties, then, in trying to empower a population that maybe feels completely let down by the system?
Part of it is actually giving them a voice at the table. You know, the city has a number of different advisory commissions. We have a transgender advisory council that the mayor formed. We have a commission on people with disabilities, commission on the status of women, one on children, one, you know, bicycle advisory committee, to make sure that perspectives we don't naturally have get baked into the system on a regular basis. And we need to give people a seat at the table to tell us when our heads are up our butts, when we're doing something that's actually counterproductive, when resources are not being targeted the right way, and when there are barriers that we just don't perceive. And if we give people that opportunity, people who are currently experiencing homelessness or people who have experienced homelessness recently, give them an opportunity to weigh in on what we're doing, that has a couple different benefits. It gives us real-world information on which to make our decisions, but it also helps counter the narrative that we started this conversation with. There is a narrative out there that people who are homeless deserve to be victimized, that it's okay to throw bleach or fire at them, that they are all criminals and that they are dangerous. And we are not hearing sufficiently on social media, in city council chambers, in the media, about the retired nurse who got evicted and is living in her car, or the family that fled domestic violence, or the vet who's been living under a bridge with PTSD. And we're not hearing about what is preventing them from being helped. And we're also not hearing the success stories of the people who were helped that give us evidence of what we should be scaling up.
That's LA City Councilman Mike Bonin. Thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, as always.
All right, now to the California boat fire. 33 bodies have been recovered after the Conception dive boat caught fire and sank Monday morning off the Santa Barbara coast. One person is still missing. Investigations are now underway into the cause of the tragedy. The FBI will recover evidence. Now, while the National Transportation Safety Board will use it to decide if other vessels need to make changes, a full report might take years to put together. And at the heart of it all, a question: what happened? Let's talk about how some of that investigation might look with Michael Berry. He runs the company Underwater Criminal Investigators. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I should say no foul play is suspected, but many investigations at sea are approached in a similar way as criminal investigations. So if you were assigned a case like this, Michael, what would be the first steps in the investigation process?
Well, once you get the call, you know, the first thing you want to do is contain the scene. You want to secure it and, you know, make sure it doesn't grow, meaning with the boat, you don't want it drifting. You don't want a debris field. You want to contain it. You want to make sure that the search area, the area that you're going to be investigating, is small as possible. So you want to contain it, make it safe.
So what would the following steps be once you've secured things?
Well, once you secure it, you definitely want to be communicating with the land investigators because they're ultimately responsible for, you know, figuring out what happened. You're working, an underwater investigator is working basically for them. We're an extension of their investigation. So you want good communication. You want to make sure that you document where the vessel is, where the evidence is. You want to mark that location, and then you want to document it. You do that through not only diving, but, you know, if you have visibility with photographs and taking a video. And then giving the topside investigators, the land investigators, giving them an idea of what you're working with. And then, you know, after they get a good picture of what the bottom is like and where potential evidence or debris or whatever might contribute to the investigation, you know, discuss with them, you know, what steps to follow, what they would like to see as far as what to do next.
How many times do you have to go underwater to get the above ground investigators what they ultimately will need?
Well, normally when we're called as underwater criminal investigators, we're called because their investigation led to the water. Normally we have some information. We know a little bit about a crime or an incident, and, you know, we know what area they want searched and a little bit about the history of the case or the situation. And then based on the environment, the depth, the conditions, the current, the water quality, we try to figure out what search patterns to use, the best way to approach it, the dive gear to be worn. You want to methodically cover, you know, the search area, and something like this, you know, everything down there is a possible clue or piece of the puzzle.
So you might be going down constantly to kind of be their guide in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And this depth, you know, the depth I've heard that they're dealing with, you know, that's not an easy depth, 60 feet. It's not super deep, but I mean, it's still, you know, with challenges, you're still limited with the tank that you carry, or if you're diving surface supply, that depth, you're really governed by the dive tables, and you're limited to how much nitrogen you can store in your body. And so, you know, you have a time limit. You know, once your divers reach that depth, they have to be methodical and know exactly what to do because they have a limited time to operate there before they have to come up. So it's sort of like a tag team, is the divers are all working together, you know, one team after another, trying to methodically, you know, search and recover any evidence or anything that might, you know, contribute to this investigation.
Yeah, I didn't even think of the time limit. I mean, you are underwater after all. You have to go back up eventually. Now, during the fire Monday, five crew members jumped overboard and survived. What part do witnesses play in this kind of investigation?
Oh, the witnesses are vital. You know, the witnesses are going to tell you what happened. They're going to tell you what they remember, what they saw. In this case, with a fire, the events, where it might have started, the history of it, and then all that is vital to that land investigator trying to figure out exactly what happened.
Talking to Michael Berry, he runs the company Underwater Criminal Investigators. When you're dealing with a fire on board a boat, what are some of the things you might be looking for?
Well, in a case like this, you're really after everything because you really don't know. You're looking at anything that could contribute to the investigation. So your job is to collect anything and everything that might be on the bottom or might be, you know, floating on the surface, anything. It's painstaking because you could imagine in a situation like this, the debris that could be on the bottom, the parts of the ship could be on the bottom, just tons of things come apart and separate. Your job would be to methodically recover all of that. And so it's going to be a time-consuming process.
Is time really of the essence when you're dealing with oceans and currents?
Well, it has a major play to it. You're looking at the currents could be moving it, the items itself, the evidence itself, or the components themselves are now affected by the salt water. So you want to be quick about it. You want to get down there and clear as much of that as soon as possible.
Now, part of what you do in your investigations is the recovery of human remains. And we've talked to first responders in the past about this process. For you, Michael, and the people that you work with, is it ever difficult to deal with some of the things you see?
Oh, it's very difficult. You know, you're put into, you know, a very emotional situation, you know, dealing with a tragic event like this. You're kind of put in a position to make the recovery and to bring closure to it, not only to, you know, help the investigation, but you're thinking about, you know, the victim themselves and then the family. You know, one way to cope with it is you look at that. You look at what you're doing, what the skills that you're bringing to the dive site, you know, with your abilities to help bring closure to it. So you're not only helping an investigation, but you're actually helping to recover, you know, someone that's lost and help bring closure to a horrific situation.
Do you sometimes have to just shut off that part that makes us human? Because this is your job, after all.
You do, and I've been doing this for a long, long time, and you know, one of the ways I deal with it is I look at them as, you know, if that's, you know, Fred or Sally down there, I actually look at them as Fred and Sally, and they're just lost, and they're in a situation, and I need to get them out of and bring them back home is one way to look at it. It's like finding a lost child in the woods as you find them and bring them back home. It's the same thing with this. Everybody has different ways of dealing with it, but that's how I've dealt with it for all the years I've been doing it.
Michael Berry runs the company Underwater Criminal Investigators. Michael, thanks for making the time.
You're quite welcome.
A bill is sitting on California Governor Gavin Newsom's desk, one of many actually, waiting to find out if it will get his signature or not. Now, the controversial bill in particular that we're going to hear about already had Newsom's support, but putting pen to paper in Sacramento sometimes goes through a little more politicking at the end of its journey. Coming up, find out what's holding up the state's vaccine legislation. That's ahead when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. The Me Too movement has touched many industries, from film to publishing to politics, and that includes the restaurant business. Now, here in Los Angeles, half a dozen former employees of a popular eatery are accusing the owner of sexually harassing them and other staff. KPCC's Elena Shatkin has been covering this story. Hi, Elena.
Hi there.
All right, so who is being accused?
Gareth Kantner, the owner of Cafe Stella in Silver Lake. He also owns the land that the restaurant sits on, the Sunset Junction shopping complex. So that makes him the landlord for Intelligentsia Coffee and the leather goods store Dean. Kantner also owns Dinette in Echo Park, and he's the son of Jefferson Airplane co-founder Paul Kantner. I will note here that through his lawyer, Kantner has vigorously denied all the accusations.
And we'll get to that in a minute. First, who is making the accusations against him?
Six former employees. Three of them spoke to me on the record. Most of the accusers say they witnessed Kantner often press himself against female servers, envelop them in long hugs and stroke their bodies, nuzzling and or kissing their necks. Three of the accusers said they were the frequent targets of this type of behavior. One of them is Hannah Steen, who worked at Cafe Stella from 2011 to 2014.
He would come up from behind often and put his hands around my waist and pull me in, and put his face up into my neck, pull my hair aside, holding me as if he was my boyfriend, caressing my body.
Steen said that sometimes Kantner would take things even further.
Sometimes he would pull my hair really roughly, like the way that someone would pull someone's hair when they were having sex. And he would kiss my neck. He would, like, whisper things into my neck.
Now, you also talked to another waitress who corroborated her story, right?
Yes. Another former Cafe Stella waitress said she witnessed Kantner's behavior towards Steen. I also talked to Steen's former boyfriend from that time. He told us that she talked to him at the time about Kantner's behavior. Steen provided us with what she says are contemporaneous entries from her personal journal that matched what she told us. And Steen says she also talked to her mother about Kantner's behavior at the time. And she provided us with an email in which her mother offers support.
I understand Steen said she confronted Kantner in 2012.
Yes, she did. Here's how she described that experience.
Something came over me, some kind of calm, and I just looked at him in the face and I said, "The way that you treat me makes me so uncomfortable." And I watched him turn into a little boy in front of me. He didn't know what to do with it. His whole demeanor changed, and he went like, "What do you mean?"
She said Kantner apologized profusely for making her feel uncomfortable and that he promised to change his behavior, but
it did not last. In fact, it became sort of worse. I mean, for a few weeks, it seemed like it was better for everybody. And then, you know, it just, it just changed and it went back to being what it was. Except for me, there was this, oh, can't touch Hana. You know, can't get too close to Hana. You know, super sensitive Hana.
What do other accusers have to say?
Another former waitress, Eve Sturges, said she also saw Kantner embrace and inappropriately touch other female staff. Sturges worked at Cafe Stella for about a year, starting in 2006. She said Kantner did it to her once, shortly after she started working there.
It was like his whole body was around me, and his lips and whiskers are like literally on my ear. And saying, you're making so much f***ing money.
Kantner's accusers said, in addition to his frequent crude, sexually explicit comments, he would talk loudly in front of others about sexual acts he wanted to perform with customers and employees.
Elena, some of the allegations are 7 years old and some are more than a decade old. Did these people say why they're coming forward now?
Several of them said it was because of the Me Too movement.
We're speaking with KPCC's food editor, Elena Shatkin, on accusations of sexual harassment by several former employees against Gareth Kantner, the owner of Cafe Stella. Now, I understand one former waitress accused Mr. Kantner of harassment in an unemployment claim.
Yes, that would be Julie Grimm Espinoza. She filed for unemployment benefits after quitting in 2006. State records show she claimed to have, quote, endured constant sexual behavior, unquote, and innuendo. She declined to be interviewed, but she told us in an email that the statement in the records was, quote, an abbreviated summary of a certified letter, unquote, that she sent to Cafe Stella, which detailed the ways she felt Kantner had mistreated her. A former waiter, Jake Demaray, told me that he observed Kantner's behavior towards Grimm Espinoza, as well as toward other female staff. Demaray also said that Kantner once grabbed him by the crotch.
So what does Kantner say about this and the other accusations against him?
We asked for an interview with Kantner, but were turned down. Altogether, we submitted more than 24 detailed written questions to his representatives. His attorney, Andrew Brettler, wrote us back. He did answer some of our questions. With regard to Grimm Espinoza, he said she never accused Kantner of misconduct or sexual harassment. And more broadly, Brettler called all the allegations against Kantner, quote, false and defamatory, unquote. Brettler claimed that in its 20-year history, Cafe Stella has never received a single complaint accusing Kantner or anyone else at the company of sexual harassment or similar misconduct.
Anything else?
Yes. Andrew Brettler said none of the allegations against Mr. Kantner have any merit and are contradicted by the accounts of numerous employees. Now, a PR consulting firm that was representing Kantner sent us written statements it said were from 6 current and former employees. 3 of these statements said no one ever complained to them about inappropriate behavior on Kantner's part. And in one statement, the allegations were called false.
Were you able to talk to those employees?
We reached 5 of the 6 people who gave statements, including a former waitress who wrote that she had never witnessed any inappropriate sexual behavior of any kind during her 7 years working at Cafe Stella. She was the only one who agreed to an interview. And in that interview, she reiterated her defense of Kantner.
Did Kantner's lawyer say anything else in his client's defense?
Yes. Andrew Brettler also questioned Hana Steen's credibility because she visited Cafe Stella after she stopped working there and because Steen tried to get rehired after she had left. Steen said she sometimes went to the restaurant because she lived about a block away and her friends still worked there.
And I would always text somebody that I knew and I said, I would say, is Gareth there before I would go? And I would only ever go if I knew he wasn't there.
Steen said she did come back to work at Cafe Stella after a 2-month trip abroad and that she tried to do the same thing a couple of years later, but was turned down. And she said after that, she did inquire about picking up some shifts and was told Kantner didn't want her to return.
Is sexual harassment a big problem in the restaurant industry?
It's a huge problem. Chef Mary Sue Milliken is the co-owner of Border Grill Restaurants and Trucks. She's been working in restaurants since the late 1970s.
It is pretty much endemic. It's in all restaurants, all kinds of food service because of the intensity of the job. There's a lot of pressure, but then as a way to kind of cope with all that, there's a lot of joking and teasing, and it often goes too far.
A national group that advocates for restaurant workers says the industry has the highest rates of sexual harassment of any industry in the country. And remember how I said the Me Too movement motivated several of these accusers to come forward? Here's how Hana Steen put it. She doesn't want other women to go through what she experienced.
When I worked for Gareth, I was a 30-year-old woman who was raised in a feminist family with a strong sense of self. And if it was that hard for me to say something and it's that scary for me to say something, what must it be like for these 20-year-old girls who come in and work for him or other people?
Thanks very much, Elena.
Thank you, A.
That's KPCC's food editor, Elena Shatkin, on accusations of sexual harassment by several former employees against Gareth Kantner, the owner of Cafe Stella and landlord of the businesses at Sunset Junction in Silver Lake. You can read much more about this story on our website, laist.com. That's LAIST.com. All right, now to Sacramento. Just a little while ago, the state Senate passed a bill that would make it harder to get a medical vaccine exemption for kids attending California's public schools. KPCC's Michelle Faust-Dragoban has been following this bill, and she brings us an update. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
All right, tell us, what exactly would the most current version of this bill do?
So basically, there are already rules that require kids who to get certain vaccines before they enter public schools here in California. Most kids in California are vaccinated. The only way around this is the requirement that you have a medical exemption, and that's common for kids who have childhood cancer, transplant recipients, things of those of that nature. And there have been some reports of doctors granting medical exemptions for suspicious and for unethical reasons. And so this bill, as it stands right now, would give the Department of Public Health more oversight if less than 95% of students in a particular school are immunized. And that is the percentage that public health researchers say is needed for community immunity. The bill would also grant public health the ability to review and potentially reject exemptions granted by doctors who approve more than 5 exemptions in a particular year.
How has this bill changed since it was introduced early this year?
Well, it has changed, and there's been a lot of really big protests in Sacramento over this bill by vaccination opponents, and celebrities like Jessica Biel have been lobbying against it. This summer, under pressure from the governor, the bill changed from an earlier version that would have added state scrutiny over every medical exemption.
Now, this bill continues to have a lot of strong opposition. What happened in Sacramento during the debate today?
Well, there were a lot of loud protests, people hollering while the senators were speaking. The Senate took a recess after a 28-11 vote passed the bill. And there were because there were these chants of "you are not representing California for all" from the audience. What this all is happening in the context of threats of violence against the bill's author, Senator Richard Pan. He was heckled and pushed in Sacramento a few weeks ago, and tweets yesterday by Governor Newsom saying that he wants some more changes to the bill, but he hasn't been specific so far.
Should we expect that the governor will veto the bill?
Well, given those tweets, it's possible. Though earlier this year, the governor was supportive of the bill after those changes, and Pan said on the Senate floor today he hasn't heard from the governor's office about changes to the bill. Pan pointed out that most doctors aren't opposed to extra levels of scrutiny. The bill is supported by dozens of doctors and medical organizations.
So the bill's just kind of sitting there waiting to find out what Newsom's going to do. What happens now?
Well, what happens now is we're going to be watching really closely what's coming out of the governor's office. But everything's going to have to be resolved quickly because the legislative session ends a week from this Friday.
All right. That's KPCC healthcare reporter Michelle Faust-Dragoban. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Scarlett Johansson has had quite the year. Forbes magazine proclaimed her the world's highest paid actress. She wrapped up her run as Black Widow for Marvel's Avengers franchise, but she will return as Natasha Romanoff in a prequel that will likely keep her on top of that money-earning list for years to come. She also has a few other films due out soon, actually this year, that's getting some award buzz. She also just dropped a bomb about Woody Allen that Twitter is not happy with. Find out what she said when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
If you could walk through,
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's film festival time. We've got a roundup of all the best movies that'll be coming out over the next few months. Plus, Scarlett Johansson prepares for award season for the first time since 2006. Oh, and by the way, she dropped a bomb that Twitter is not happy with. Let's go on the lot.
God, my witch.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
The Hollywood Reporter's Rebecca Keegan is here with me to give us our entertainment news roundup. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, let's start with the box office. The summer movie season runs May to Labor Day. So what's the verdict on 2019 summer?
Well, the box office in the U.S. and Canada is about $4.32 billion. That's about a 2% decline from that period last year. Interestingly, ticket sales revenue is down 6.3%. So it's not that great. The reality is there are some movies that performed quite well, Lion King, Avengers Endgame, Toy Story 4. But there's something that those movies have in common, and that's that they're all made by the same studio, Disney.
Yeah, $4.2 billion doesn't go as far as it used to, Rebecca.
No, it doesn't. Yeah, not really, you can't even get through Whole Foods with $4.2 billion.
So what are analysts saying about why the box office is down from last year? Disney movies aside, obviously.
Right. Well, one of the things that's interesting is that because of the proliferation of streaming services and the low price that those services are offered at, and also you've had the emergence of plans like MoviePass, where people were able to see movies for a low price, some folks are saying that people have now been trained to expect to get movies for cheaper than you get them when you go out to the theater and pay your you know, 12 or 15 bucks or whatever you're paying to see a new film.
Now, all is not lost, though. There are quite a few highly anticipated movies that will be released in the fall that could give the box office a bit of a bump, right?
Yeah, there's an It sequel. There's the Joker movie. Frozen 2 is coming out. Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, which we've talked about on the show, won't be playing in the big change, but will be out in independent theaters. Those are all movies that could drive people out to see them.
All right, speaking of highly anticipated movies.
You're growing up too fast. 10-year-olds shouldn't be celebrating war and talking politics.
That's from the upcoming film Jojo Rabbit, one of the two Scarlett Johansson films she's starring in this fall that could put her on the awards route. What's the other film, Rebecca?
The other movie is called Marriage Story. This is the one she stars in opposite Adam Driver. They play a couple whose marriage is sort of dissolving. It's directed by Noah Baumbach, and it's gotten some very strong reviews as it's made its first two festival premieres.
And you actually flew out to London and spoke to Scarlett Johansson while she was taking a break from filming Black Widow, her Black Widow film. How involved is she in that upcoming prequel?
She'll have an executive producer credit on the film, but she's had input into the script, the director choices, casting choices, that sort of a thing.
So she's got a little bit of power now.
She does. She does. And interestingly, that movie, when it comes out, will be the first female-fronted movie to kick off the summer box office season. It's going to open in that early May slot that's usually reserved for male-fronted movies.
All right, now to the Twitter elephant in the room, because she was very candid with you on a wide range of topics, but the one that is causing social media to blow up today is what she said to you about Woody Allen, the director that she's made quite a few films with. What did she tell you?
Well, I just asked her what she thought of Woody Allen, and she said that she loves him, that she believes him when he tells her that the allegation that he sexually abused his daughter is untrue, and she says that she would work with him again.
Why do you think she said that? I'm just wondering, because we live in this cancel culture, Rebecca, where anything that gets in the way of making money, of making profits, you know, could come back to haunt her. So is she comfortable enough now in who she is and maybe her status in Hollywood that she feels that she can just say whatever she wants?
I mean, look, she is actually the highest grossing actress of all time. That's thanks to largely to the Marvel movies. But I do think she has a kind of unusual quality in an actor in that she doesn't seem to mind displeasing people. She's not sort of trying to be the most popular person in the room. So she apparently believes her friend Woody Allen, and she's comfortable saying so. It has gotten a very strong response since we posted the story, however.
One other thing on that, Rebecca. You were sitting right in front of her when she was telling you this. What was your sense? What were you reading from her, from how she was telling you this?
Well, I mean, I did ask her if that felt like kind of a fraught idea to express, because we are in a cultural moment where the idea of believing women, believing people who bring forward allegations of sexual abuse is important, and there's sort of a real emphasis on it. And she, interestingly, completely agrees with that idea. You know, she's been active in Time's Up. She is considers herself a feminist. I think she sees this as being a very complicated issue, and one where she feels differently about this person she knows well versus a broader issue as a whole.
All right, let's shift gears ever so slightly into the kickoff of fall movie festival season. That's where films like Johansson's Marriage Story and Jojo Rabbit are getting some attention. Let's start with Toronto. Toronto International Film Festival. What films should we watch out for there?
Right. TIFF kicks off tomorrow, and there'll be a lot of interesting stuff there. Eddie Murphy will be there with a movie called Dolomite Is My Name. This is a Netflix movie. There's going to be a Harriet Tubman movie, Cynthia Erivo, The Lighthouse, which is the Robert Pattinson kind of black and white, interesting movie getting a lot of attention. And some of the movies that had premiered at some of the other festivals, Marriage Story will premiere in TIFF as well.
All right. Tell us about Telluride. What's getting buzz and why?
Well, Telluride just wound down. I just got back from it. There are two movies there that seem to get the kind of stamp of approval from everybody who saw them. One was Marriage Story and one was Parasite, a Bong Joon-ho movie that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. Those films seem to be sort of squarely now in a Best Picture race. Interestingly, because Parasite is in Korean, you don't often see foreign language movies sort of playing this well at a festival, but it did. Another movie that did really well there was Ford versus Ferrari. This is an auto racing movie with Matt Damon and Christian Bale that was a real crowd pleaser.
Now, one more. Let's talk about the Venice Film Festival and the movie getting a lot of attention there.
You don't listen, do you? You just ask the same questions every week. How's your job? Are you having any negative thoughts? All I have are negative thoughts.
All right, that's from the upcoming Joker film starring Joaquin Phoenix. What are people saying about the film, Rebecca? I'm a little excited, but you know me, I'm into the comic book stuff.
Yeah, but this is different from your typical comic book movie. For one thing, it's rated R, which is unusual. The reviews were quite strong coming out of Venice. Joker is directed by Todd Phillips, who is the director who made the Hangover movies. This is a very different turn for him. People are likening it in tone to some Martin Scorsese movies, King of Comedy and Taxi Driver, and saying that it's extremely dark and Joaquin Phoenix's performance is really kind of twisted. Most of the reviews have been positive. There have been a couple of negative ones. One was from Time magazine, which said it wants to be a movie, quote, about the emptiness of our culture, but really is offering a prime example of it.
Rebecca Keegan is with The Hollywood Reporter. She joins us every Wednesday to talk about all things showbiz. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Ever wish you could write a novel? Okay, so maybe you've written several novels. They just haven't been published yet. But are any of those anywhere as good as, say, Walter Mosley? That name should be familiar to any aspiring novelist. I mean, Devil in a Blue Dress, Six Easy Pieces, yeah, him. Well, now you might be able to, with his help. Find out how when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Devil in a Blue Dress, White Butterfly, Six Easy Pieces. Acclaimed author Walter Mosley has written more than 50 books, many of them crime novels centered around the fictional detective Easy Rollins, an African-American private investigator living in the Watts neighborhood of Los Angeles. But Mosley has also written nonfiction novels, a play, a memoir, and now The Writing Guide, Elements of Fiction. So we asked him to come in studio to tell us all about it.
My name is Walter Mosley, and I'm the author of Elements of Fiction. Why do I love writing? That's a really difficult question. You know, it's like, you know, why do you love your mother? Or why do you love sunsets? Or, you know, it's that kind of thing. It's that large a thing in my life. I really enjoy writing. I get some response. Some people seem to like it. ideas or feelings that I have, I can work out while I'm writing. But all that said, I don't know. It's just, you know, you love something, you just do. When I wake up in the morning, I sit down and write every day, 365 days a year. While I'm writing, ideas rise to the surface. After I've written, unconsciously, ideas are rising, and then the next morning, they rise to the surface again. And I might be working on the book that I'm writing, which, you know, it might be an E.Z. Rollins mystery or a novel about history or a nonfiction book about writing fiction. So it's a rolling process. So there's just, I'm writing. There's a term I came up with in Elements of Fiction called the structure of revelation. And it was like, how do you create revelation in a piece of fiction? What is revealed to the reader? You know, when you find out what person was in the room at that time. You know, all these moments, you know, there that you go, oh my God, now I understand. There's all of these structures that exist that we need to have inside of plot, inside of story, inside of character. And I thought I would just talk about that a little bit so people could think about it. You know, I've written, I don't know, 57 books, something like that, some more. So I've, you know, been thinking about it for a long time. And I said, well, I could put it in a book. The interesting thing about characters in a novel, you know them better, the writer and also the reader knows them better than they know people in their lives, because they actually know what they're thinking, how they're reacting, what they do in their private time. You know, we know people, you know your mother, but you know what your mother does, you know, when she, you know, goes into a room and closes the door. You know, you don't know what she's done in her life. You don't know anything about them. But as a writer, sooner or later, the essential moments of this character's life are going to come out. And not only that, if it's one of the major or important minor characters in the novel, there'll be a progression. They're going to start in a place with their feelings and their ideas, and they're going to get someplace completely different. And that's kind of the satisfaction that people get out of stories and novels, how somebody actually learns something, changes to some degree or another. And that's what's kind of the satisfaction that people get out of stories and novels, how somebody actually learns something, changes to some degree or another. Every character is a journey. One of the great things you learn from poetry, there's no word that doesn't belong there. And, you know, in fiction it's not as bad, but you have to think about each word. So, well, why are we using this word? And why are we using this series of words? And why did they just say that sentence? You know, why, you know, what kind of language are they speaking? You know, it's a really difficult thing. Like sometimes I'll have some of my characters, they'll be speaking in a very educated kind of way. But when they get really upset, they revert back to the language that they used when they were much younger. And, you know, it's angry and, you know, and it's truncated and it's, you know, there's cursing in it. And you feel that in life, right? You're talking to somebody and you know, they're so nice. And one day they come and they're cursing about something. And you go, wow, this is different. This is what's going on here. You know, it's the same thing when you're reading. I can't predict what other people are going to feel. Oftentimes people respond to things in my novel that, you know, I wasn't even completely aware that I was putting it in there. And I know for a fact that everybody who reads a book, it becomes their book. And it's no longer my book, it belongs to them. There's no difference in writing and rewriting. The same thing to me. I write out something, and I'm really happy with it. Oh, I wrote this novel. And then I go, and I read it, and I go, oh, well, now why did that happen? Now, where were they going? Like, isn't that person dead? And you know, it's just like all of this stuff you got to go, oh, my God, it's not working. So then you rewrite it, you know, and you rewrite it, and you rewrite it, and you rewrite it, and you know, rewriting is all kinds of different things. You know, for myself, every, you know, once in a while, I'll just stop and I'll read the whole novel into a tape recorder just so I can hear it, you know, because there's a lot of it has to do with the narrative voice, but then also the voice of the novel. There's a kind of a magic to how a novel sounds. Mm-hmm. people often ask me, they'll say, when do I know my novel is finished? Because, you know, novelists are obsessive. And I always tell them, well, you write it and you read it and you see things are wrong, then you fix them. And then you read it and you see things that are wrong and you fix it. And you read it and you see things are wrong, fix it. Maybe you do that 20 times, maybe 25. But at one point you read it, you see things that are wrong and you can't fix it. You don't know how. And that's when the novel is finished. Well, I think a lot of people believe that they don't have ideas. And so they think that they can't write, or they have an idea that feels too big to write about. But this is what I always say to them is, I look, give it 100 days. Write about the idea or something every day for 100 days. At the end of that 100 days, you'll probably know what you want to write. But you have to make that investment. No matter where you are in this world today, you're living in a state of capitalism. And in capitalism, there's a hierarchy and there's a structure, and you have a specific job because it's production line kind of logic. And if you only do that, then it's really hard to have ideas. Because, well, I put the left front tire on the Pinto. That's what I do. I do that every day, all day long. So, well, yeah. Then you say, well, what would you like to do? And the answer probably is, well, I would like not to put the left front tire on the Pinto anymore. But you don't get much beyond that. And so I think that you have to allow yourself and also make yourself do something else. And one of the things might be, you know, I mean, you could do anything, but one of the things might be, well, every morning get up and write for an hour and a half. Just write. And the next morning get up and write about the thing you wrote about yesterday. Keep writing about it. And do that again and again and again until you finally get somewhere.
That's Walter Mosley telling us about his new writing guide, Elements of Fiction, out this week. Mosley will be featured as part of Live Talks LA tomorrow night at the Museum of Tolerance. You can find out more information about that event at livetalksla.org. Our conversation with Walter Mosley was produced by Take Two's Sue Carpenter. Finally today,
I want somebody to hold my hand.
Singer Jackie Wilson, once known as Mr. Excitement, received a posthumous star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame today. Wilson was a crooner in a category all his own, combining sex appeal with sophistication, soul, and signature dance moves. He charted his first number one hit back in 1958 with Lonely Teardrops, a song co-written by Berry Gordy of Motown fame. A heart attack in the mid-1970s brought his career to an abrupt halt, but his brief time in the spotlight would influence several performers, including Michael Jackson. Wilson died in 1984 at the age of 49. His star can be found on Hollywood Boulevard near Sycamore Avenue.
Hey, you! Come out here on the floor. Let's rock some more.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. So if you missed any part of this show, and I highly recommend you go back and listen to it, just go to Get Your Podcast, and there we will be waiting to be listened to by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two, at Take Two. You can find me there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
Forward, step, now it's plain to see.